Hey Fresh Capital listeners, we're continuing our breakdown of investment sectors to watch, and in this episode, we are looking at EdTech. Educational technology has been supercharged since COVID-19 forced many of the world's students into online learning environments. But EdTech is more than school over Zoom calls. EdTech includes the hardware and software to digitize our classrooms, make learning mobile, and using AI to increase learning outcomes for individual students. There's so much to get into in this space. Keep listening and enjoy. Welcome to another episode of Fresh Capital. Every week we provide a refreshingly simple way to learn about companies and investing. My name is Dan. Joining me, as always, Albert. How are you doing?
Dan, I'm going good. We didn't talk about this just now before we started recording, but I was in New Zealand earlier this week. So going good. First overseas,
that's right.
First overseas trip in 2 years.
Yeah, making international deals, Albert. How was it? How was New Zealand?
Good. You know, I kissed some hands and shook some babies, as they say.
As they say. I mean, it feels odd as you say that. I immediately thought of, you know, the Queen passing away. Obviously, someone who's had their fair experiences of shaking babies and kissing hands. Thanks, Lizzie, for your service.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Today, we're going to be talking about EdTech, though. Albert, why do you think about EdTech as the theme for this week's episode?
Not much of a transition from Lizzie to EdTech, Dan, but I'm glad we just tackled it head on. Look, I mean, as we keep talking about thematically Asia Tech on this pod and probably making the shift, I think what always occurs to us is like how technology is solving the problem of scale in Asia. Like there's always just this huge sheer volume of people, particularly China, India, Indonesia, etc., and trying to deliver a service at scale is always very difficult to do. And then when you layer on like really essential things like education and the problems of delivering education at scale, it just made it a really interesting topic of conversation for this pod as to how you can leverage education tech to kind of bridge the education gap in the region.
Yeah, it's as you dive into it, there's just a lot of potential services which fall into the EdTech category. And so I've kind of liked how our deep dives have taken a bit more of a bird's eye view and just looking at certain sectors, looking at mobility, for instance, and now looking at education technology. I think as we've been doing in our previous couple of episodes, Albert, let's give like a nice little definition of what we mean by EdTech when we start off this episode. To me, EdTech includes essentially the hardware and software technology used to educate students on a virtual level or even in classrooms to improve learning and enhance students' education outcomes. So I think it's pretty broad, pretty generic, but there's some, you know, pretty specific use cases that you can think of with that definition. Obviously, using Zoom or other software like that to facilitate online learning can improve education outcomes. If you think about using AI to, you know, prompt particular questions for students to aid them in their sort of learning journey, also a good example. And then there's, if you're taking away from the student focus and looking at teachers, all the different tasks teachers have to do in a classroom, and there's many technologies which can help them organize and facilitate student learning, which is also, you know, a focus of EdTech. Anything to throw into that bunch, Ab?
No, I think that's a really, really great great overview. I think you're completely right. Like Zoom isn't specifically an ed tech business, but it obviously has applications in enabling the delivery of education. It just shows like there are specific education tools out there, and there's like fringe education tools. And then there's tools that we'll talk about like YouTube that have been, you know, commandeered for education. I think the layer I'd add on to your definition is like you can segment it from a B2C perspective, which is like technology that supports students to learn, you know, different concepts, curriculums, etc. And you know, a company we've spoken about on the pod before is Duolingo. Like, I think that's a great example of like a B2C education business. And then there's like B2B, education tech. So that's like tech that supports teachers or education providers in the delivery of education or kind of back office functions. So again, we talked at the top of this pod about like ProctorU, which is an exam taking piece of software. And then there's also a business called Canvas or Moodle that does like white label education hosting platforms for universities.
So Albert, let's start with why Asia is, you know, as a particular spot for ed tech to be fruitful. Obviously, we've talked on previous episodes about the huge population rise. Asia in particular has a somewhat young population, excluding, you know, Japan and some of the developed countries. But China, India, Indonesia have got, you know, huge populations under the age of 30, which are coming through. Interesting sort of factor specific to the Asian culture is, you know, there's just a higher proportion of income spent on education for families. Education is really, really valued in those cultures. Anything else that makes Asia a sort of hotspot for edtech, Albert?
Yeah, I've kind of dived back into my consulting toolkit and kind of broken this down into like situation, complication, questions. And so, you know, you're completely right when you talk about the situation Asia being, you know, like billions of people. I think, you know, it's close to a billion students and children in Asia who need education. Then when you layer on this like critical mass of people, there's a lot of complications and challenges with educating that many people. Obviously, there's a huge language barrier in Asia because every country speaks a different language. You know, the education quality differs in Asia. There's obviously some really top-performing schools in, you know, Singapore, in Indonesia, like Jakarta, you've got international schools. In Japan, you've got really strong schools. But then that obviously varies in other countries like Thailand, the Philippines, Vietnam, etc. But as a whole, the education quality in Asia and the region lags behind its Western counterparts, particularly at the, you know, the pre-12 part, but also at the tertiary education part. And then because of how expensive quality education can be, it becomes pretty inaccessible. And so students are turning to online education. But again, the challenge with online education is that it's not necessarily curriculum-driven. And those qualifications, if you get qualifications from online providers, aren't internationally recognized or may not be as reputable as, say, like, you know, going to a university in person or taking the online version of, say, like Oxford or Cambridge or, you know, ANU, et cetera. And so I think all those challenges combined with the fact that you've got, you know, close to or more than a billion people in Asia who need education makes it a very interesting melting pot in terms of innovation in the space.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, as you say that, one of the reflections I had was it almost feels like currently our system of education is still really reliant on our traditional, you know, primary school, middle school, high school, university, where so much of ed tech in the region is about facilitating that experience, you know, online tutoring, etc. You're learning particular aspects of information of learning that are required for exams, but required for exams in the traditional sort of pathways. Less so some of these like certifications, as you say, Albert, because still the dominant certification that everyone's after is, you know, that university degree, high school diploma, that sort of thing. With some exceptions, obviously coding, etc., I think is a little bit more liberal in terms of the job market recognizing those qualifications. Pausing there for a second, Albert, I feel like we can't go 10 minutes into the pod without sort of mentioning how COVID has changed the game for ed tech and online education. Really interesting sort of data has come out now over the last couple of years since COVID has started to tail away. But, you know, essentially, if you take OECD surveyed countries, not necessarily representative of all of Asia, but a useful sort of survey, only 22% of schools surveyed think that they want to go back to teaching as usual, which leaves like a huge proportion of schools that are seeking to change the classroom experience, combine in hybrid learning, remote teaching, et cetera, et cetera. And this is a huge impetus. Like, it's one of those, what do they call it? Like a black cat event, Albert, where black swan event, where it's completely changed the field. And there's now so much more openness about this idea of having education technology in our classrooms for students.
So funny you say that, because well, we probably shouldn't discuss how, like, thematically the education system's broken, because it is like a system that was developed in like the manufacturing era for a particular purpose. But the fact that there's been no like evolutionary pressure put onto the education system until this global pandemic is, to me, crazy. Like, it's like almost centuries old as a system and hasn't really evolved from like classroom years, you know, set segments of what you learn and things like that. And so, you know, whilst COVID has had a radical change across lots of industries, like, I definitely feel like education is probably one of the ones where it's had a complete 180 and influence over the education system.
All right, Albert, let's go from the general and now into the specific. What's like a particular type of ed tech or particular company that sparked your interest when looking at ed tech in Asia?
Yeah, I don't know if there's specifically a company, but something I do want to talk about first is mobile first, because I feel like you can't talk about anything in Asia without talking about mobile first, and then specifically talking about like mobile first digital education. And so, you know, we talked about Duolingo before on this podcast, but I think it's worth revisiting that model, particularly in light of your just comments now about COVID and how that's disrupted education. So traditionally, how you learn is in a classroom. Like, you go to school in a classroom, you learn, you know, an hour of math, an hour of science, etc. And that's kind of it. You do your homework at home, but you've got these like set segments, which doesn't really sit well with like a mobile first world like Asia. And Duolingo has come in, and you know, you can read or listen to our Duolingo deep dive if you search through it in our list. But it's really just empowered students to learn something, specifically education, on demand, get instant feedback in the same way you would in a classroom, but anywhere in the world. Like, you can do it on the train to school, you can do it while waiting for dinner, you can do it while cooking. I know, Dan, you use Duolingo, so probably good to get your take. But, you know, in terms of education, I really see mobile-first education in Asia being a key driver in addressing some of these challenges.
Absolutely. And for those wondering, my Duolingo streak is up to 300, so it's going strong.
Nice.
but I mean, that touches on a point which so many of these mobile ed tech applications lean into is gamification. And this is huge in Asia. I remember, you know, we're talking about Taobao and some of the Chinese e-commerce companies. They're leaning into gamification to try and get people to be purchasing on their app and platform. Gamification is definitely a tool which is being used in ed tech. And I mean, it's. I remember when we were in high school, Albert, which would be what, like 10 years ago plus now, we had Mathletics, which would have been, you know, the first sort of in Australia idea of a gamification of learning maths. Did you use Mathletics?
No, I was playing normal video games like Pokemon.
You know, but it was essentially like we would compete in the classroom. We'd all be sitting on the computer. Up on the screen would come up, you know, I don't know, 7 times 9. And then it's just, you know, quickest to do the answer. Like, really easy gamification for math. It's obviously pretty simple. And then you build that out into more complex algebraic questions and equations, all that sort of thing. And you can do the same with most classes as well, particularly because so much of learning is sort of rote memory. It really lends itself to gamification. And so much of the statistics and the data that's come out of these platforms has shown that students do perform better when there's a gamification. There's more engaged. They're retaining information better when that's involved in their learning.
Nice. I think the next kind of topic I do want to move into is like talking through the education value chain and kind of the different companies in Asia who are doing some interesting things. Because education itself, while different in every kind of country or region of the world, kind of goes through the same kind of steps around application, enrollment, you know, learning, exams, graduation or some sort of accreditation, you know, post-graduation, whether that's like jobs and internships, and then like ongoing learning as a professional. And there's lots of Asia tech in the region that has done, you know, built businesses in each of these areas. So kind of talking about the first one, there's a great business here called Applyboard, which we kind of talked about at the top of the pod. But generally speaking, as a student, you're looking to go to university, you're presented with like different options. And in Australia, I'm not sure if it's called UAC, like you can go to the UAC website or whatever it is now, and look for different courses. So if you want to study, say, law, like all the cool kids do, you can go to UAC and type in, you know, law, and it'll tell you like, here's all the institutions that offer law, and this is what the entry requirements are, and this is, you know, what the different courses are and things like that. Now take that on, Australia's obviously a very small country, but take that to like a bigger scale, like the US or in China, India, etc. You're trying to work out what to study. You know, US has like thousands of education institutions. If you're in China, India, Indonesia, etc., you're trying to work out which education provider to study abroad at. Like trying to work that out is very difficult. So you've got these application businesses like ApplyBoard, SchoolLynx, Jealous, Graduate, that really solves this problem of like what courses to apply to, who provides the best learning outcomes, and then like what the admission criteria is.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing on this business model, Albert, is, you know, who's paying in the end? So where does the money come for the business that's trying to facilitate students going to different universities, different schools? What's the end part of that value chain?
Yeah, so I mean, in the end, like, you know, the university gets enrollment money from, you know, students who pay course fees and things like that. But the key thing in application is some providers take a clip of the course fees, some providers take a subscription fee, some providers just get advertising cash. So the model does change, but it's important to call out that it's a very lucrative market, international students. And so if you can support students in that journey, you can make a pretty healthy clip.
Yeah, I found this example interesting when we were talking about it before we hit record, Albert, just because when I thought of EdTech, I was thinking very much of like in-classroom experience. This is a good example of EdTech is a little bit broader than that. This is very much about facilitating mobility, movement, pre-classroom, and getting people to the place where they want to get the sort of best learning outcomes. Do you want to stick on this topic a little bit more, Albert, or are you happy to pivot away?
No, let's move into kind of the next part of this value chain, which probably more of a B2B play, but it's around admissions and enrollment. So if you're a university, you know, again, this is not necessarily directly around curriculum or learning, but it's also worth calling out this is another part of EdTech, which is you get heaps of paperwork for admissions. You've obviously got to like enroll people. You've got to reject people. If you've got domestic and international students, the documentation's different because you've got to like check visas and things like that. And so it's quite administrative to do enrollments. And then when you're, you know, looking at applications, it's quite difficult to assess objectively which students to admit versus not admit, and do this in a standardized way. So this is where, like, you know, a lot of businesses are starting to leverage AI around admissions and enrollment to see who they admit into their businesses, who they admit into their university, sorry, you know, how you train models and things like that. So also a very interesting space.
I like that Freudian slip of calling universities or schools businesses, which, you know, to an extent they are, and that's something that we've got to sort of recognize. I do sort of want to pivot away from this, Albert, a little bit, because we're talking, I guess, sort of back of house for the schools and universities. And I think we can sort of bridge that gap going where I want to go and keeping this conversation, talking about some of that infrastructure that schools need by talking about like classroom management portals. So these are, you know, apps, platforms, et cetera, which schools are using to help manage their classrooms. As you were talking about, Albert, getting rid of paperwork, getting rid of administration, all the sorts of things which, you know, people say keeps teachers away from doing what they do best, which is teaching students. And the sort of company that I wanted to spotlight on this one is one that we know quite well. It's Google. So Google Classroom is one of the most used EdTech apps in Southeast Asia. And I found this fascinating because I had never heard of Google Classroom. Not sure if that's because, you know, they're not as prevalent in Australia or just because of my age. But, you know, it's essentially importing the whole Google suite. Like you can think of how there's Microsoft Teams and its whole suite for business. Google's almost doing the same, but in the classroom where, you know, they've got Drive, Docs, Sheets, Forms, Mail, Chat, all of that, which integrates into the classroom setting, as well as some, you know, classroom-specific things. You can, as a teacher, create a room, individually add students that are going to be, you know, attending the virtual class for the day. Like, it's just really, really interesting to me that Google's playing in this space. And then what we love, Albert, is controlling, you know, the full stack. And then I sort of started to realize, you know, who's a major supplier of laptops in US schools? It's Google with their Chromebook, with almost 60% of their laptops being in K-12 classrooms in America. You start to get this idea of, oh, Google's really leaning in to not only the software side of education tech, but also the hardware side of education tech as well.
It's pretty crazy. Like, I'm just reading a stat now. There's 150 million people using Google Suite for education, like Google Classroom, which is what the product's called. And, you know, you're right, it plays across, you know, not, it's not just Google Suite rebranded for education. Like, they've got assignments, they've got grading, you know, they've obviously used Google Meets and scaled that for a classroom environment. They also do like plagiarism checks. So Dan, I don't know if you remember Turnitin, but Turnitin is a product that scans someone's document and then checks to see whether it's been copied and produces like an originality score. But they also do an originality report within the Google Classroom product, which leverages obviously like the Google Search Index. And so it's not just like a rebranded Google Suite. It's like its own unique standalone product, which, you know, it's incredible. 150 million students using it each year.
Incredible thing was 2 years ago in 2020, it was at 40 million. So that shows you sort of that COVID spike that's occurred, you know, over three times the amount of users now using the platform. And what's really interesting for me, Albert, as we look at Google getting in, is like, is this what the future is going to be? Because in some ways, I know you sort of, it was an unintentional slip calling a university a business. But if I think of all of the software service providers and hardware providers that are trying to get into businesses to service them, but is anyone looking at schools in the same way saying, look, there's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of schools where we can provide laptops to, in the same, like, the laptop hardware needs of a school might be equivalent to that of a small business. You know, they both need 50 to 100 laptops sent to them. They need all of the software support, etc. To me, it's like a really interesting space, and usually it's underwritten by government, so even more lucrative.
I think the important thing to call out is like what Google could do with this wedge. We haven't really trawled through Google's annual reports to see if they are looking to push further into education, but they, you know, can obviously index a lot in education because they've got all the content and they can aggregate content very easily. You know, they've also got like a B2B education provider where they can, you know, teach people particular skills like SEO and things like that and certify that. But what is an interesting play is that Google becoming an education provider, leveraging its like search index and aggregation. Because, you know, to your point, Dan, the business of university has not changed or really evolved. And these universities and these institutions, they're so kind of entrenched in their own power and that they don't necessarily want to evolve. Like, they've got this incredible monopoly on education that gives them power. And so when you've got an education provider, in a sense, like Google, who's coming in to collect data and make a wedge in the business, it's interesting to see long-term how that plays out.
Yeah, and I think just to sort of close the loop on this topic, Albert, is if you're an ed tech provider, I see it as there's two places you can play. You can either try and make your money off all of the students, in which case I think it's more of a volume game. You know, your students aren't going to be paying you thousands of dollars each year. It's going to be a much smaller amount, you know, maybe like a $5, $10 subscription, but you make your money by hopefully having huge margins, by having, you know, a product which you can scale, and also just by having more and more students using it. The other side of the playbook is, as Google is doing, is you target the schools, which is just sort of a smaller volume game, but arguably much more high value. Like the value of the contracts that Google would have with a school would be in the thousands, tens of thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars plus. So if we wrapped up that sort of business to business play, Albert, do you want to look a little bit more at the D2C play?
Yeah, this is a great transition because, you know, when you talk about the value chain and learning, we've talked about admissions, we've talked about enrollment, we've talked about delivery. I think the next step is obviously from a learning perspective and curriculum perspective. And there's like so many companies now providing either education content or curriculum replacements for students. Like the big one, obviously, globally is Khan Academy. Like, Dan, do you ever use Khan Academy?
No, never.
Oh, really? Really? I mean, I used it.
That's so terrible.
I used it like religiously all through high school for like science, math, and then sometimes at university. You know, and now they've even broadened to like finance and things like that. So Khan Academy is pretty useful. But in Asia specifically, like because of the challenges of you know, high quality content and education, there's been a lot of businesses who've moved to make platforms that do very specific things. Like there's a business called QMath, which is like a math learning platform for kids. So if you want to learn, you know, complex or easy maths, this is really targeted like kids from, you know, year one equivalents, like 5 or 6 to about 15, 16, you can do that. There's a business called Scalar, which is focused on technical skills. So if you want to learn like data analysis, if you want to learn like coding, there's a business called UpGrad, which is targeted at postgrad students. But thematically, what these businesses are doing is either complementing an existing curriculum that schools provide, or in some cases, even just replacing the curriculum entirely and being the content and knowledge source for students to learn from.
Yeah. This to me is like the classic what we think of when we think of EdTech. They're the ones which the students are going home and logging into and doing after class to facilitate their learning. In Indonesia, a really sort of prevalent one of their unicorns is Ruang Guru, which is an online tutoring service. It also has obviously like the, what do you call them, like the modules which you can go through online, et cetera, et cetera. The interesting question I have on this one, Albert, because I think it's so ubiquitous that, and people sort of know it, that maybe we shouldn't go too deep into it. I want to go into this sort of question, which is it all going to consolidate? Because to me, there's not too much difference between the services each of these sort of direct-to-consumer companies are providing. Yes, there's, I think, specificity between this one's teaching you how to learn a language, this one's teaching you how to sing. That, I think, there's good diversity. But in a world where there's Duolingo, how many different language learning apps can there really be? In a world where there's, you know, one app which is cornering the market on learning how to sing, how many of those apps can last?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And for me, I think it comes down to two things. The first is like personalization of learning, is that when you've got so much content floating around, like you and I, any student can learn anything now in the world, but you know, knowing where to start, you know, knowing what content to show next based on what I'm learning, and then knowing what to show me based on what my overall outcome is something that is much more difficult to do, right? I can go learn about chemistry from 20 different sources, but none of those sources are going to be specifically tailored to my learning journey and my specific learning outcome. It's like whether I want to just know about chemistry or whether I want to be a chemist. And so I think the players who can solve for that are going to be the ones who rise on top of the content aggregators. And they might be a content aggregator themselves who don't create content, who just have a superior algorithm in the way that TikTok can show you what you want. Like they can pull content from these different providers. But I think that's a key thing.
Yeah, the AI is really powerful here. So my experience with this was, what was I doing? I was doing the test for the GMAT. So that's, I think it's GMAT, isn't it? You go overseas to an American university, you need a GMAT score. But so I bought a tool on the recommendation of a friend. And essentially what it does is there's hundreds of modules, hundreds of of sort of learning exercises, and it will tee up the next class or the next learning module based on how you've been progressing. So if I've been doing poorly on, in this case, it would be something like maths, you know, rather than me doing reading comprehension, which as a lawyer I'm very strong on, it would be giving me more and more exercises to of the maths ones, which I wasn't getting correct. Those sorts of things, as you say, Albert, is really where I think that the genius is in these apps. And it's also a nice moat, because once you start learning on this platform and it starts understanding your needs, how to become better as a learner, it's kind of a high switching cost to then go to another app. You have to train the AI. You're starting from fresh again. You're probably doing modules which are too easy for you. It's an interesting sort of business problem, which ends up, I think, affecting user experience and switching.
For sure, for sure. And I think once you combine this in like an education provider context, like, you know, like Duolingo is a good example, but that's not done at scale by education provider. If you can replicate education and like AI-driven personalized education at like an institutional level, I think that's really powerful to then deliver the best outcomes for students with the reputation of education provider.
I mean, the other interesting insight that I'm just thinking of here, Albert, going from my example, is how do you promote some of these apps? Because I think it's a pretty... it's an easy sell. If I'm like on a train or something and I see an advertisement saying, download Netflix, download Amazon Prime, like I can watch all these fantastic things. That's fun. But education, I think, is somewhat, you learn for a specific reason. Like, you know, I might be traveling to Spain, so I hop onto Duolingo to learn some Spanish. I think it's kind of hard to think how some of these apps gain scale when, to a certain extent, I think people don't want to be learning in their free time. Like, there's that barrier to entry, isn't there?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, education's almost always like top down. It's like your parents tell you to study, right? Yeah. How many students, even studious students, drive bottom up, like, I'm going to spend my free time studying.
And my money. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, versus I'm going to play Elden Ring or, you know, League of Legends or, you know, just, you know, hang out with my friends and things like that. Like, it's very difficult to do that. I think the key is like having the social proof element, which is like teachers advocating, parents advocating. And that's who these businesses sell to, right? They're appealing to the decision makers, which are parents and teachers, even though the users are a completely different base.
Well, this to me, again, I think we've sort of segmented. I was saying, you know, which would you rather be? Would you rather be a D2C ed tech business or a B2B? For me, it's B2B is a little bit more interesting. But again, you could ask yourself, would you rather be playing in the sort of tertiary and above space for education or the kindergarten to year 12? And I think that insight about like parents being pushers, to me, is I would much rather play in the K to 12 space, because you can rely on the parents to be pushing students through the door onto your app, onto your business platform.
Yeah, I think we would probably need to see data on how sticky that is, because, you know, at that the K to 12 space, it's obviously very saturated where you can learn from literally everything. But when you get to like higher order education, like university, where the content is much more difficult and less commoditized, then I think that is a stickier product.
Nice. Albert, any last thing to hit on?
Look, I think there's probably one more point. And so we talked about ed tech specifically around like schools and curriculum, but obviously going to school, you get other things like extracurriculars. And if you're trying to replicate the education experience online, which a lot of these businesses do, you also need to replicate the non-curriculum specific skills like extracurriculars. And you know, not to... to be super generic about it, but in Asian countries, there's always a big push on extracurriculars. You know, in classic Japan, there's like all these different clubs you can be involved in outside of school. So there's a couple of pretty interesting businesses in Asia who are doing this. There's a business called Doyobi, specifically targeted at that, like, you know, K to year 10, you know, 16-year-olds, etc., where kids can learn. It's a platform very similar to Khan Academy. They learn like non-content specific skills like confidence, speaking up, critical thinking, citizenship, so like how to be a good citizen, what life means. And so they're really trying to replicate like the non education specific skills that you would learn tangentially in the classroom. You know, there's another business called Yellow Class, which does like extracurriculars, like piano learning and other extracurriculars, but at a micro learning environment. So it's like you're watching like 2 to 10 minute long videos about, you know, how to play piano or violin or tennis. And then there's a business that I'm sure a lot of people will love called Bambinos. They're from India. But again, ed tech around extracurriculars, but they've really broadened out to do things like esports training and communication training. And so trying to get students to understand, you know, there's more to life than just learning educational content for an exam. And how do you do that? You can do that through Dyobi, Bambinos, Yellow Classes, and businesses like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting to me, Albert, because I think so much of our education is geared towards employability. And so when you start talking about things which I think are more skill-based in the sense of, you know, the music learning or even like confidence, tech, coding, all these sorts of things which aren't your traditional like learning maths, English, all that. To me, the extension of that is asking the question, at what point as a society in various countries will we get to where I don't need a university degree to get a job, I don't need a high school diploma to get a job, I can just have, you know, 30 hours on Bambino or something like that, and that becomes my proof of skills, my certification. Because once you reach that point, to me, that's a huge boom for edtech. That to me is a turning point where all of those businesses become exponentially more valuable.
For sure. And, you know, something we haven't even talked about on this episode yet is like post-education learning. Like, you know, a lot of education is so geared on the assumption that most people just get a job and don't necessarily learn outside of like on-the-job learning, but that's not true. Like people do post-grads, people want to learn technical skills associated with their job. If, you know, you're a lawyer, an accountant, whatever, you've got to do like your personal development and keep learning. If you're a surgeon, you've got to keep learning. And there's not many people who are tackling this problem of like post-education or career learning, which is starting to gain a lot more traction in Western countries, and it's slowly starting to get traction in Asian countries.
Well, judging by the online modules I have to do at work, Albert, every 3 to 6 months, there are companies tackling it and they don't do it very well.
I mean, those are super specific to law and things like that.
Oh, they're super boring. The platform is super ancient. It's not a good experience.
But I think the outcome itself is not geared towards a great learning environment, which is like you're just trying to tick a box, right? You're not actually, not to besmirch on it, but like, you know, how they deliver this for, say, surgeons is obviously very different to how they deliver professional development for someone who is, you know, a programmer versus a lawyer and things like that.
All right, Albert. Verdicts. Final thoughts.
I think there's a really great opportunity in Asia Tech. I think maybe not B2C, but definitely in the B2B space. You know, we didn't talk about it when we did the intro, but there's 16 EdTech unicorns in Asia, playing in a lot of different spaces, but the majority of them are B2C. Just the sheer nature of market size means you can build a business like that in China. So things like NoBox, which is a homework support business, iTutors, which is like a Taiwanese tutoring online business. But as education providers mature, I think there is a big opportunity in Asia around B2B.
I agree. I mean, when I was looking at how Google has gotten into the space, I couldn't help but think like this is one of those things which is the future and no one's talking about it. The one caveat I'll put on that is there's a really interesting discussion to be had about privacy. Like if we already think that some of our social media companies are having, you know, the third degree microscope put over them by governments, just wait until they start getting into the classroom, start gathering data on our kids, on our children. There's just going to be a next level amount of scrutiny on these companies. And it's really interesting because part of the Google classroom interface is that these kids are signing in with their, you know, Gmail account. And so there is naturally a sort of data gathering exercise that's occurring there. And I wonder if these social media companies, because of their social media side of the business, are almost going to get precluded from ed tech because governments are really going to want to keep those two things separate. So that's just sort of like an interesting flag, I think, to look out for. But like you, Albert, I'm really bullish on ed tech. This is such a traditional sector with so many flaws to it. It's ripe for disruption. I think there's a lot of tailwinds for ed tech businesses.
The funny thing is, like, you know, I think a lot of people agree that AI and personalized education is the future of education, but you can't be anti-data collection and support personalized AI, because you need something to train the model, you need something to provide feedback. It's probably something to be said around, like, you know, data sharing, so that if your child is doing education through Google Classroom, that data is not then being sold to, like, advertising and AdWords and things like that. But you can't have it both ways, because, you know, if you're trying to improve learning outcomes with data, you need to have data about your particular kid in order for them to learn, in the same way that, like, Netflix learns your viewing and watching preferences. You know, someone learns about your education preferences and outcomes.
Yep. Okay, Albert, let's finish up there. Thanks for listening to the Fresh Capital Podcast, a podcast about companies and investing told in a refreshingly simple way. Thanks for the shout outs we've been getting. I think our last episode got a nice little LinkedIn plug, which, Albert, I thought you'd set up through one of your networks, was completely organic. So that was really, really cool. So if you're listening and you feel like sharing the episodes, please do. We really appreciate it. We'll catch you next week. Thanks again.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Fresh Capital. Every week, we provide a refreshingly simple way to learn how companies operate and how investing works. Just a reminder, all information contained in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional, financial, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of Fresh Capital are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Any opinions expressed in the show are not recommendations or advice. Please consult a licensed financial professional before you jump in. As always, we look forward to seeing you next week. See ya!